This week's episode was brought to you by the non-corporeal transverticulating dinosaur spiders that live in the fourth dimension of the rhomboid horror dimensions, where they lord over the wealth of enslaved souls who labor unceasingly to produce water-based lubricants for sample condoms at your local Planned Parenthood. If you'd also like to support The Whole Rabbit, please visit www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit. Where not only will you get access to all our extended episodes, you will get sent a fancy sticker and an invite to our illustrious Discord server, which is a hotel for goblins. This week's episode, we discuss the grandfather of chaos magic, Austin Osmond Spare, his early life as an artist, his legacy as a magician, and how to perform his sigil method and the death posture for chaos magic, fun, and profit. In the extended episode, we get Mari very drunk and discuss the Book of Pleasure, the Anathema of Zos, and Humping the Ugly for the Mystic Dao powers. Thank you, and enjoy the show.
And from then on, like, all animation movies were done with computer assistants?
Yes. Like, for the backgrounds especially. Yeah. Or, like, if they're flying a ship or a car, they would render it. And then they do a technique, actually, that was developed in the 60s or 70s called rotoscoping.
Yeah, and it looks like it's 3D sometimes.
And Ralph Bakshi did that for a while. There's also a movie called Scanner Darkly that I'm a huge fan of. That's completely done in digital rotoscoping by a computer.
Philip K. Dick book.
And, it is. But the one thing that sucks about that movie is that they actually had to record the whole movie live action, you know, then they just fed it through a computer processor and rotoscoped it. And then basically they paid the people as voice actors instead of actors.
Oh,
yeah.
Like, they could pay them a lower wage because they weren't, their image actually wasn't on the screen. It was like a computer processed image of it.
There's another movie by the same director, I believe. It's called Waking Life. It's really good.
I don't like that director per se. I mean, I'll need to look at his other stuff. But I mean, the Scanner Darkly movie was good, but I feel like I need to read the book. My roommate says the book is a lot better.
The only book I read from him was Valis.
What is that about?
Jesus Christ. Techno
is it
Jesus.
Is it like a digital savior?
We talked about it a lot a couple of months ago.
We literally did a whole episode
Valis
on
it. Valis is awesome.
I thought I've heard it before.
I hope so.
Have you guys heard about... Okay. Dingus.
Okay.
Why don't you sit down, okay? I want to have a talk with you.
I've already heard it, I think.
Okay, but please never do math.
I know.
Please don't do it.
I wasn't particularly interested.
Okay, please don't do it.
Rectal meth.
But I kind of hate Coke. I mean, heard that burns, Malachor.
Rectal meth.
Yeah.
Is that safer?
It's like my new band. We got to make this band.
Rectal meth. Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Whole Rabbit, where we do more than just gently caress ourselves to the candlelight and the strange squiggles on the piece of paper to manifest ourselves a new job at the fast food joint down the street, which makes us toss the dough on our heads while wearing a strange blue nightgown. Nay, we become one of the world's best painters to ever walk the earth and tell everybody to fuck off because we'd rather bang old ladies for the devil, because this week we're discussing Austin Osmond Spare. I'm your host, Luke Madrid, the Hacking Rabbit. I'm joined this week by Marisama, the Noodle Mama.
Noodles.
Floyd J. Henderson. Rest in peace, Brandon. They tried replacing you with an asshole on our truck.
Dr. Dingus, the morning and dreadful.
I'm Floyd motherfucking Henderson. Sorry, that was a fucking nickname he gave me. I gotta stick with it.
And the mischievous malcontent Malcor 5.
Hola.
You can hear his dissatisfaction.
Yo, Dingus, what was your nickname? Dr. Dingus?
Dr. Dingus? My nickname from Brandon?
On the crew.
Oh, Floyd J. Henderson. Floyd motherfucking Henderson, yeah. I actually fucking went out of my way to watch the movie and, like, learn the whole scene. And then when I saw Brandon at our new job, I'd make him laugh, you know, by doing the scene. But he keeled over from some fucking fentanyl-laced coke.
That's fucked
rest
up.
Rest in peace, Brandon.
He was a good dude. He was a good dude. What about this crazy motherfucker they call Austin Osmond Spare?
Yeah, he's the grandfather of chaos magic, BT Dubs.
Also, I was intrigued to find out that the way I make my sigils is exactly his teaching.
Yeah, this guy was like essentially the beginning of chaos magic in the West.
I'd say it's around in the East. I think the yin and yang symbol really kind of just puts it down to its simplest form. But that might have been
Other practices.
Yeah, that might have been my old mind saying that.
And non-practices that he doesn't even give guidelines for. Like, he's just like, you know, go for it. Whatever you feels good. And I'm about that.
I've never cracked a single grimoire. All my shit's chaos magic.
Well, some of the things...
And that's what I learned. It's not... Chaos magic isn't, you know, integrating the dark and the light together. It's not that.
It's just using it.
Well, it is, in a way, because you pull on both. At the same and often at the same time, which is why it's chaotic.
It's I think in Spare's words, it's to like tap into the unconscious. That's mm-hmm. the focus of it. Get in a trance, do whatever you got to do, get in a state of mind and let it flow through you.
Let the hate flow through you.
I mean, all of us together, a lot of us are chaos magicians anyway, because we buck authority. That's part of the ritual. Is to question things and to explore on your own. But, you know, it's really interesting that the founder, the fact that we can approach things in a way that is detached from things, but we still draw on the powers of both black, white, and even gray magic. And a lot of people would even classify chaos magic itself as gray magic for that very reason.
That's kind of why Gandalf wears gray. He's not like Saruman wearing all white and like a pristine wizard.
Gray is a symbol of like wholeness.
Yeah. Or
contradictory elements brought together.
Or a mixture such as a storm, which I would attribute to chaos. Like hot and cold air meeting creates a storm. It's inevitable.
I feel like an important part of chaos magic is resting on some different principles from Aleister Crowley, but somehow still being related to Aleister Crowley. Like Austin Spare was an acquaintance of Crowley. They worked together for a short period. He did some work for him. And then Genesis P. Orridge basically had her own like Aleister Crowley experience. And we talk about this in our Chaos Magic episode where she did the Coombe transmissions. She borrowed heavily from his imagery and she was treated the same way politically for putting the same things on display and making them holy when they were formerly unholy, but doing it in a more DIY fashion and outside of a hierarchical framework, which Austin Spare was entirely opposed to. And from a modern perspective, he was pretty palatable. He was an animal person. He was a lifelong opposer of fascism, a supporter of minorities, suffragettes, and he was just kind of an all-around unpretentious dude, unless he had a pen in his hand. Then everything changed.
Oh, God. This guy is actually kind of hard to talk about because so much of his teaching is wrapped up in his terrible writing. I don't like it,
to be honest.
It's like college poetry. I don't even know how else to put it. Like some kind of weird academic poetry.
I was reading some of his work, and it was almost word for word what I wrote when I was his age.
Was that diss? What? Did we just diss you, Malcor?
No. Yeah. No, it's just true.
Well, like, okay, but how sophisticated is his writings compared to, like, the Cult of the Subgenius or even, like, Discordianism?
They're sophisticated, but they don't really get a point across. It's very flowery.
You know, and that's a version of me that's dead now. So you're talking shit about a dead person, pretty much.
Hadn't stopped me before. Exactly. Asshole.
We're talking shit about a dead person if we are talking shit about anybody.
I mean, I relate to him on the strict fact that we probably both had ADHD.
I really dig this dude.
Yeah, he's interesting, and he's largely responsible for bringing the occult to like the common man, should they desire to learn.
Yeah, that's the point, man. That's what I'm
kind of thing.
But mostly, people smarter than us read his books and then translated them to English, and not whatever he was writing in.
Precisely. We can blame Phil Hine and Peter Carroll for taking a lot of his ideas and making them so easy to understand that it became limiting for a lot of people.
Yeah, because they essentially established like a school out of it, like a way to interact with chaos magic that's organized.
Kind of, sort of on accident, yeah. Although if you read Peter Carroll's work, he continues to evolve and change. And Phil Hine also became a sincere hermeticist. So it's not really on them, you know what I mean? But it's on the movement. And then the movement is always like, hey, chaos! Woo! I'm a chaos magician! How do I become a werewolf? You know what I mean? Like,
well, another thing I was going to say is even if people go crazy, they still look to you for direction. Like in the human, when we socialize as humans, there's always directive to look to the leader to see what to do next. You can't really deny that chaos magic needs to be organized in some way, but who's to say that that is done by dictating laws? It's probably better done by just writing it down. Because people will grasp onto it if they need to use it. The idea of making a school of chaos magic with like rules and like lessons to learn is kind of...
It's not a terrible idea for starting out, but you limit the potential of it.
If I really thought about what a chaos magic school would be like, I mean, has anybody ever took an independent study where you have to like make a project and you have a whole semester to do it and there's no teacher? There's just like a proctor?
Oh, yeah, I've had something like that.
Yeah, but like you have free reign to do whatever you want. You can make you can do a research project. You can make a model and explain physical attribute, you know, but they allow you to do your own independent thought and research. And I think that to me, if you went to a chaos magic university, it would be a lot of independent study. And there's really basic rules that he outlines and stuff. But I really appreciate that this guy doesn't really get into the, oh, well, you have to wear a red robe on Tuesdays and turn counterclockwise in three circles before you do this ritual or else it won't work.
He hates that shit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But he also gives us a guideline enough to where we can craft our own practices on our own, which is what we're supposed to do.
One of the things that I find most interesting about Spare is the fact that I think that chaos magic could have only come out of England at this time, because Spare had this interaction with like these kind of this new generation of ceremonial magicians and you know, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, you know, all that shit going on in the 1800s in England. But England also has a very, very long tradition of witchcraft.
Yeah.
Even after the church came in, and I see chaos magic as kind of like the natural collision of those two concepts.
Yeah, but the church is also an authoritative, rigid structure that it was. I feel like chaos magic might have been a reactionary movement to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, in large part, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. You know what else who Spare reminds me of? He reminds me of Jack Parsons, because they both interacted with Aleister Crowley and it was a big turning point for them in their life, where their interactions with Crowley and their resultant work in occultism overshadowed the rest of their life's accomplishments to a ridiculous extent. Where, you know, we have Jack Parsons, who more or less invented solid rocket fuel, the first JATO units. He more or less invented the Polaris missile, helped found Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And then Austin Osmond Spare, definitely one of the best artists to ever walk the earth. And he one of England's best sketch artists.
I have a hot take into what you just said, Luke.
But he revolutionized occultism as to how these scientists revolutionized technology. It's the same thing. It's just a parallel.
Malachor, what is your hot take?
Well, if we're comparing him to Jack Parsons, Parsons probably was somebody who was down with the order and down with ceremonial stuff, and just his scientific brain understood the science on how to get us to the moon. So things had to be a certain way. It just didn't work. Rockets don't fly being a chaos magician. Sorry, but I think that's how you can compare their both of their successes still being overshadowed by their occultism. Well, and I guess the point I'm trying to get it to is the brain, is the mind of the person who makes these achievements, whether it's artistic or if it's scientific and military kind of shit.
Well, to answer your point on that, you could say that Jack Parsons definitely followed, you know, had to follow the laws of physics, chemistry in order to achieve his goals. But here so did Austin Osmond Spare have a mastery of art. He could do his sketch artistry was we'll talk about who he was compared to, and rightfully so. But he also did like pop art, and he could really do anything. He had a mastery of the medium. He didn't have a lack of skill. His skill was, let's say, as a craftsman, he was a master. It would have been nice for him to have that same level of skill when he was writing.
This was a hard episode to research.
Well, let's talk a little bit about his life, and we'll get into some of his occult works, and probably for the extended episode, we'll talk a little bit more about how to use them. So we begin on Snow Hill, where Austin Osmond Spare was born in 1886 in London, England, to Philip and Elisa Osmond. Philip was an officer in the City of London Police, and the couple lived in a tenement inhabited by families of police officers, drivers, clerks, and market workers. Spare was the youngest of four surviving children. He first attended the school attached to the St. Sepulchre's Church at the top of Snow Hill, which, during his daily walk, brought him through the Smithfield Meat Market, which was shocking and disgusting to the young Spare, who had a lifelong love of animals.
Jesus, I could only wish. If I knew where a fucking meat market was when I was a kid, that'd be where I was hanging out. I did used to go to the farmer's market just to torture the live crabs. Or I would if I was 8 and could drive. I'd have to get my dad to take me. And then I'd torture the crab.
Dude, Dingus, why don't you become a butcher?
I thought about it.
Dingus the butcher.
No, please. No shit. My friends in fucking Wallacourt. Like,
hacking and hacking.
Hacking and smacking. Yeah, I know that one. Yeah, my fucking friends in Wallacourt have been calling me the Butcher of Georgia for 4 years.
Oh, that's hot.
Yeah, it is. So yeah, let's tell you about the witch Patterson.
I really like this part of his lore. This is like my favorite part.
Yes.
Spare's family raised him Anglican, and he was 7 when the family moved to Kennington, South London, where he attended the St. Agnes School. It was during this time in his life he would later claim to have encountered a Miss Patterson, who, according to Spare, was a witch of the Salem lineage, who Cotton Mather had failed to exterminate. That's just a weird name. Although biographer Phil Baker asserts this is purely of later fantasy, Spare claims that the grotesque witch Patterson seduced him, initiating him into the ways of magic and giving him a lifelong attraction to older women. Oh, my man.
Oh, boy.
A man likes a gilf. I don't feel...
I'll take him.
If you want knowledge and power, you know.
I don't know, man. After the recent Chris Chan debacle, I don't want to hear about any fucking guilt.
Sorry, I don't trust older men a lot of times, so.
He wants big hangers.
I like a good 10-year age gap.
He wants the long milkers.
I've only done 5.
He wants the long milk.
I prefer an older partner, so. Whatever. Although his teacher had a limited vocabulary, she beheld a
That's all, folks.
No, it's not.
Although his teacher had a limited vocabulary, she beheld a powerful grasp of abstract metaphysical concepts and boasted powerful supernatural ability. According to legend, Patterson was capable of materializing her thoughts into physical manifestation and creating visions of the future for her clients. Using this ability, she was capable of glamour, transforming herself from elderly into a beautiful young woman. Spare painted her in both forms. Spare claims to have traveled with her upon the Witch's Sabbath, which he said occurred in spaces outside of space.
Woo!
That were incomprehensible to the material world. That reminds me of something. I'll tell you all in a second.
Reminds me
According
of something
to too. Austin Spare, it was Miss Patterson, his beloved witch mother, who anointed him with Zoss after initiating him into the cult.
Quick note, glamour magic is a form of red magic, which is an illusionary magic.
Red.
It's easily seen through, too. It only works on dim wits.
Oh, how could you say that?
I mean, it works on some of the best of us, but we'll see through it eventually.
I mean, if you're unless consenting you're to it, I mean, if you're getting blown by like that old like hag
okay,
lady,
a glamour,
she's just, like, she turns into like some soft, sparkly, like
a glamour
stardew, fucking dripping
okay.
goddess,
bro,
slobbering but, on your yep. knob. Like,
remember, okay, remember The Shining in the room with the ghost woman?
That was my favorite scene.
That's a glamour. That's yeah. a glamour.
But he started the act with her looking all corpse-like, and then she turned
but he
into
saw her,
the,
no.
He was into it before she glamoured.
Mm. Can I tell you about this schizophrenic that said some shit that's kind of vaguely related
Go
to this?
Go for it.
He did claim to be 7. He did claim to be 7. I don't want to leave that out.
Oh, yeah, I figured there was some fucked up shit in there. 1800s. Anyways, it's actually a friend of my dad's. I've never seen the guy, but apparently he would get like just intermittently and suddenly violent. But it was a schizophrenic friend of his who claimed that he was pursued by spirits and demons. And the way he said it specifically was they come out of a direction that we can't go in.
Oh,
that's just a really interesting thought.
Dude, that makes me think that it might be real.
This reminds me of Twin Peaks a bit, too.
Gotta walk squaggingly.
It's not like these ladies are walking out into the forest and humping on a goat, man. They're flying there through the spaces between the spaces.
And then they fuck a goat.
Then they fuck the goat. That's, yes.
No, they materialize and then they dematerialize.
She gave him the keys, whereby he gained access to the witch's Sabbath, the genuine extraterrestrial event of which the popular version is but a debased and grotesque parody. It was during his exaltation to the dimension where this event occurs that he was taught how to explore the subconscious with the use of sentient symbols and the alphabet of desire described in the Book of Pleasure. These methods, once demonstrated, had to be brought down and earthed. It took several years for Spare to integrate them with his own creative techniques. Kenneth Grant.
That's important because Kenneth Grant was a student of Aleister Crowley and would later, probably rightfully so, claim to be heir to this spiritual leadership of the OTO. He created Typhonian OTO. And so this guy is knows what he's talking about. He is a little guilty for bending things in his own creative direction with Thelema, but I think it was in a good direction. It would not be irregular to see Typhonian OTO members in the Chaos Magic groups that I used to at least visit. So here you have Kenneth Grant, who's a big Crowley student, is saying this guy was an expert. Like, he knew what he was talking about, basically. I mean, that's kind of a big deal, right? I mean...
Yeah. No, Kenneth Grant is a serious dude, for sure. Mrs. Patterson, if you were listening to the previous episode, if she is real, whether she's material or not, you know, she could be like a spirit, you know, that used this man, Spare, to do some like earth magic, like in this dimension to make things move. You know what I mean?
I think that's the preferable. That would be preferable to seducing a 7-year-old boy.
Yeah, that's pretty wrong.
Just say. But I mean, I don't know. It's kind of cool. Like, I had a witch friend that introduced me to magic.
Well, like a lot of people, like, you know, there's just rumors that she didn't even exist. You know, for that to even happen, you must have been like a mysterious person anyway. And you probably do have like some egregore energy going your way. Just you're like some entity now.
She wouldn't be the only one from that region to have some skills.
I'm sure there's more than just Miss Patterson.
Oh, man. So now
this
that
is what. I feel like this is why a lot of, like, in the ancient times, priestesses were used. Like, it was matriarchal in the church.
Like skinwalkers, you know, like those native stories about...
Well, females are shapeshifters naturally because we're the mother, the maiden, and the crone.
It sounds a bit harsh to jump right from women to skinwalkers.
Time. I'm just saying that women, we have an allure about, we have a natural glamour.
Yes, that is true.
And yeah, that's why women are usually the proctors or the priestesses of magical orders, is because we have the glamour already and we don't have to do anything. It's just natural.
We've mentioned it before, but there are scientific studies to suggest that once a man, heterosexual man, smells a woman's taint, his ability to discern her looks in terms of his own personal preference decrease significantly. So this seems to support your proposition.
It also works 50% on women too.
And considering how much witchcraft involves using, like, especially if you want to seduce somebody, like using a little bit of your menstrual blood or some of your stuff in that person's food and essentially ingesting it and taking it into their olfactory sense. So it seems like a reasonable
assumption. That's the kind of blood magic I'm into, but not against people's wills, of course. Right.
Now that we've talked about Spare's sex life, by the age 12, Austin Spare had taken an interest.
Now that we've talked about Spare's sex life, here's what he did when he was 12.
Yeah, we're getting up to 12. We're up to age 12. So he had taken an interest in drawing, but it would not be long before people started to take notice that he was really fucking good at it. He was enrolled in evening classes at Lambert School of Art, and it would not be long before two visitors, Sir William Blake Richmond and F.H. Richmond RBA, came across some of Spare's drawings. They were impressed and recommended him for scholarship to the Royal College of Art in South Kensington. He achieved further attention when his drawings were exhibited in the British Art section of the St. Louis Exposition and the Paris International Exhibition. And in the 1903 year of our Lord, he won a silver medal at the National Competition of School of Art, where the judges, who included Walter Crane and Byman Shaw, praised him as having a remarkable sense of color and great vigor of conception.
this just pretty much supports my hypothesis that artists are chaos magic vessels that are co-opted by other people in society for their own means.
I mean, when you get down to it, art is kind of like a sigil.
Any kind of artist or a musician, anybody that creates something that's ethereal in that manner, that communicates emotion, which is the subconscious, strictly translated into something that resembles perhaps a sentence or something that people could understand.
Pitbull is Gandalf the Grey.
It's basically your subconscious trying to scream out and say a sentence, but it comes out in the form of a blurb of art or like a melody or a rhyme that you can't get out of your head.
And you had me at subconscious screaming.
But these people that are in tune with this chaos energy, I feel like is Sir William Blake Richmond the Sir William Blake?
Yes.
The poet?
Yeah, and I'd love to do a fucking episode.
And he's scouting people to illustrate his poems. So notice how there's people trying to they're trying to find and collaborate with visual artists at the time, because again, photography was in its infancy at this time.
Yes.
They would still need to hire a painter. These people would go and they would vulture around these artists and scout them out and then pull them into their enterprise. The artist in historical context is always not, I wouldn't say a slave, but we're definitely indentured servants. We depended on the patronage of not only the mercantile class, therefore salesmen, people that are advertising or selling goods, but we also depended on people that wanted to promote their own artworks or their own hobbies, like AKA the nobility class. So I feel like as a chaos magician, the reason a lot of us are personally, we're all artists, technically.
Very hard writers. Very hard to find somebody that won't just pay you an exposure.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And so we're very easily manipulated because we do want exposure, but at the same time, we should be paid for our services. I feel like chaos magic in the magic world, in the world of the orders of magic and like what you study and all that, it's probably like a starving artist level, you know? But that's what gives it its power, because it's able to maneuver and change and actually adapt to situations that these higher orders, they're not flexible enough to do that. There's advantages to doing this.
All right, so hear me out. Much like Crowley, he could have rested on his skill as a painter or an artist and never got into occultism. Same way Crowley could have just been a mountain climber. And he would have been legendary for that. Unfortunately for Spare, though, he found the teaching at the Royal College of Art to be dissatisfying and began dressing flamboyantly, making fast friends of the prominent leftist campaigner and suffragette Sylvia Parkhurst. He rejected...
Pankhurst.
What did I say?
I'm sorry. You said Park. I just thought her name was funny.
It is Pankhurst.
Pankhurst.
Sylvia Pankhurst.
Pankhurst.
He's trolling.
He rejected...
I thought it was funny.
He declined on Christianity. And he took a keen interest in Western esotericism. He had read several books by Madame Helena Blavatsky on the subject of theosophy, including Isis Unveiled, but did not stop there and continued onward to Cornelius Agrippa and Eliphas Levi before the internet, showing a proclivity for the esoteric. In my opinion, this is one reason the grandfather of chaos magic comfortably deserves his title. He borrowed what worked for him and discarded what did not from a broad set of esoteric work while staying faithful to the pursuit itself and devising his own rigorous techniques to accomplish works that fascinate and mesmerize to this day.
He also never became a fascist or opportunistic in his character and maintained integrity towards the inner planes of initiation rather than outward accomplishments, titles, and devoted followers. Also, in classical chaos magic tradition, he wrote his own grimoire in college while living at home with his parents, opting to title it Earth Inferno, which borrowed heavily from Blavatsky's notion that the earth plane was in truth hell. Copies of Earth Inferno were purchased by Pankhurst and other friends from the college. Luke is highly sympathetic to this notion, having been exposed to it through the same theosophical channels from a young age. I stole your fucking thumb.
My mom just told me from like when I was like first learned to speak, she's like, Luke, life is a bitch and then you die. This is hell. Don't let anyone convince you that there's something worse than this. And I know for a fact that she was getting this from Blavatsky as well. So like this, I'm sympathetic to this idea mostly because of Helena Blavatsky, like, getting to me all the way in, like, you know, the early 90s.
Well, I'm sympathetic to it because of Jacob's Ladder.
As the story goes, right, like, when the rapture happens, like, Earth is going to be hell.
Yeah, depending on what kind of Christian you ask, yeah.
Yeah, for, like, thousands of years?
No, for thousands of years, it's supposed to be pretty cool, and then God says, you see how it could have been? All right, fuck you, here's new heaven. Heaven 2!
That sounds crazy.
Yeah, there's like a 56.27-year period where scorpions are stinging your dick continuously, and then your dentures fall out, and
ow,
like spiders crawl up your butt, and then...
I used to read about that shit when I was a kid, and it terrified me, because I thought, I'm probably going to get left behind.
I'm trying to get left behind.
And then hell, I am now.
Your urethra turns into a burrito for hellhounds. I don't know.
Three-headed dogs just ripping it up.
Biting into your donut sphincter.
Eating that narrow urethra. Only a man with a narrow urethra would call that a Christmas tree. That's my Cotton Hill impression. Thank you. Have a good night.
It's a three-headed Mari attacking you.
What? Bark, 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 bark. Bark, 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 bark. Bark, 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 bark.
Now,
nobody explain anything.
Bear was influenced by works of Charles Ricketts, Edmund Sullivan, George Frederick Watts, Aubrey Beardsley, and his style focused on clear lines, which was a stark contrast to the college emphasis on shading.
Yeah, so he kind of like the comic book style, like not so much shading going on, just hard lines.
Illustrations, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it would all be illustrations anyway.
Yeah, that's why I dug his style during his time, because everybody else was trying to make it hyper-realistic.
In May 1904, Spare held his first public art exhibition in the foyer of the Newington Public Library on Wallowworth Road. Here, his paintings illustrated many of the themes that would continue to inspire him throughout his life, including his mystical views about Zoss and Kia. His father then surreptitiously submitted two of Spare's drawings to the Royal Academy, one of which, a design for a book plate, was accepted for exhibition at the year's prestigious summer exhibition. Journalists from the British press took particular interest in his work, highlighting the fact at 17 years of age, he was the youngest artist in the exhibition, with some erroneously claiming that he was the youngest artist to ever exhibit at the show. According to the media, G.F. Watts allegedly stated that young Spare has already done enough to justify his fame. Well, Augustus John was quoted as remarking that his draftsmanship was unsurpassed, and John Singer Sargent apparently thought that Spare was a genius who was the greatest draftsman in England. At 17!
Well, listen, prodigy. He's fucking special.
Just a prodigy.
Man, I wish I had talent. Anyways, having attained fame from an early age, he found the entire situation exhausting. Throughout Spare's life, he would not rise far beyond destitute poverty despite his spectacular skill. Robert Ansell suggests that his awkwardness robbed him of being world famous and abundant in wealth, for he had been able to commit himself to a moderate amount of sketchwork. He would have been able to amass a fortune. He just didn't like people. Being praised as the future president of the Royal Academy of Art amidst the fanfare, he unceremoniously withdrew without attaining any official qualifications from it.
They were like, you're going to be the president. He's like, okay, I'm out. Fuck this.
Fucking badass. Fuck all that. He was obviously interested in more mysterious things, I think.
You know what's kind of fucking strange? When I was researching this episode, I got up from watching one of the documentaries and I said, this time I'm going to make money.
Spare made a living creating book plate illustrations, one of which was called The Resurrection of Zoroaster, featuring beaked serpents swirling who looked like they were about to perform Chili Down as they swirl around the figure of the ancient Persian philosopher, a piece that brought once again Spare's work into the Royal Academy of Arts summer exhibition. Around this time, he published his first political comic, which lampooned the use of Chinese wage slaves in South Africa. While doing commission on these various projects, he was assembling his Book of Satyrs, which essentially was a book of illustrations, which included provocative titles meant to satire society, authority, social mores in general, and of course the church. We might think of these as extremely fancy political cartoons. Some mocked business, some mocked fashion, and of course religion. The volume contained a number of self-portraits. He also filled many of the images with illustrations of bric-a-brac, of which he was a great collector.
I like bric-a-brac.
Homeboy loved bric-a-brac.
You know what his illustrations honestly remind me of a lot?
What?
Have any of y'all ever seen the Black Paintings by Francisco Goya?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. It includes Saturn devouring his son and two hags eating soup and that picture of like Satan teaching a bunch of witches and shit.
I was actually going to bring up Saturn devouring his young later on when we talk about the death pose because it reminds me of that.
Oh, we should do it again because the Black Paintings are fucking incredible. They're like some of my favorite pieces of art ever. But I don't know, just like the political weight of the pieces reminds me a lot of the Black Paintings. And it's also got this kind of still has like this dramatic kind of posturing and these moody environments like those old romantic paintings did.
What about The Scream? Would you classify that as part of this?
Huh.
Mm, that's really
The Scream is like a newer iteration of that, but it's still the same kind of existential, like,
existential
terror.
Dread on what a year peaceful was that? Day.
I believe it was like
1893.
Yeah, it was like almost into the 1900s.
The movement is called Proto-Expressionism.
So he would have come out of, like, he started doing his work at the turn of the century, like 1904 and beyond.
Oh, that's
He's very young, though.
So I didn't know The Scream was older than this. That's interesting. Spare claimed to be one of the first surrealists. He had visualized the irrational and transcribed his vision directly from subconscious strata of the psyche. He was also able to galvanize primal centers of awareness by a formula of atavistic resurgence that few artists and fewer occultists have succeeded in reactivating with impunity to their work or to themselves. A quote by Kenneth Grant.
What does that word mean? Atavistic. Relating to or characterize. I'm having a hard fucking time tonight. Atavistic. Relating to or characterized by reversion to something ancient or ancestral.
Of finding a pattern, so to speak.
Okay, yeah. Here's another definition. Atavism. In biology, an atavism is a modification of a biological structure whereby an ancestral genetic trait reappears after having been lost through an evolutionary change in previous generations.
It's an undo button.
Pretty impressive before computers.
Well, Kenneth Grant's philosophy has to do with backwardsness, going back towards the source, towards the beginning, instead of
return to monkey.
Instead of a final end.
Return to monkey.
Yes. But like return to like squiggly, like chili down bird serpents.
Well, like the like chaos, you know,
snake
before
men with flippers.
Before the cosmos.
Okay, I have a okay, according to brain neurology, the way that your brain works, okay, your frontal cortex is a growth that happens in mammals, and then the core brain is something that birds and other animals have, like regular animals that are like proto-mammals and stuff like that, and things that aren't quite. And then you have the lizard brain, which is pretty much your cerebellum and the growth right above that, which in people and human beings, that would be what we would call the subconscious brain or our autonomic nervous system, which regulates breathing and, you know, all of the chemical reactions that happen.
Yes.
We don't will that to happen, but
so both of these occultists would conceptualize that realm, that world, as you go further and further down into the brain, is the underworld. And so you're supposed to be like drawing things from this world
or finding reflections in it and then drawing upon that and building upon it. Right.
It's like a well, and you can see the moon if you're looking into the well in the night, you know,
full moon,
you know, you can still get some stuff out of it, even though it's down from where you're at, you know?
Yeah,
you're drawing up, but you're making an action based on what they're arguing is that you should use your subconscious to orient your actions.
Yes. To be fair, it is difficult to talk about, so we can cut him a little bit of slack.
It was easier when Jung said it.
Now, Mari says
he didn't like Jung and Freud. Didn't like them. He didn't like both of them.
Well,
no, but I see, you know, I really do see some repeating themes in their work.
Jung lines up with this, not Sigmund Freud, but I feel like maybe at the
anal
time
phase.
This guy was around, maybe he viewed, because Jung at the beginning was a student of Sigmund Freud, so maybe he viewed them as one entity, and then he didn't really read his later writings.
Fun fact, Sigmund Freud, he wrote a book called Uber Coca about the positive mental and physical health benefits of binging cocaine.
La Coca.
Cocaine.
Cocaine.
Go grind them.
Fucking Arnold.
Yeah. Was that a good one?
Sounded right.
Oh, okay. I see. Fuck me too then.
In 1907, he had his first major art exhibition featuring his black and white drawings. It attracted sensational press and international attention. He was widely compared to Aubrey Beardsley, with reviewers commenting on what they saw as an eccentric and grotesque nature in his work. The World commented that his inventive faculty is stupendous and terrifying in its creative flow of impossible horrors, while the Observer noted that Mr. Spare's art is abnormal, unhealthy, wildly fantastic, and unintelligible. On the other hand, he could and often did produce straightforward works of art as fine as Dürer or Rembrandt, as his friend Hannen Swaffer once observed. I agree with this sentiment.
Man, it's kind of, I'm just now thinking about it too, but all of his art and writings would wind up in some kind of degenerate art exhibit in Nazi Germany.
Well,
yeah.
Well, they are a genius, and then here's the reason why, is as an artist, you do have to learn the basics of rendering reality on a two-dimensional plane. You have to learn that first before you can actually make your work into these quote-unquote impossible horrors. Like, that is called abstracting the artwork. So abstract expressionism, abstracting all of these movements that had to do with warping what you saw in reality. Like, they render it like it's real in surrealism, for example. But it's a kind of cartoon and stretched version of reality. And you have to have the fundamentals of what reality looks like before you can actually progress as an artist to actually bend the rules of reality in a way that impacts people in this way.
The jazz of visual art. The jazz.
I'm saying he has a foundation. He's not
He's
not spinning shit out of nowhere. He actually have a drawing foundation, and I'm looking at his artwork and I can see that.
I can see it like a jazz player,
you know, just getting in the groove and just like, you can see them tranced out. They got their eyes closed and they're like, got boogers hanging out and they're just like playing.
But the important part is these people are actually grounded to reality when they're doing this.
Yeah.
And that's the important part, because a crazy person can scrawl chicken scratches on a piece of paper with their own shit. And you can call that art. But at the same time, these people actually, they're channeling some kind of intelligence.
Jackson,
and they're able to do that. And same as Rembrandt. Rembrandt just draws pencil drawings of realism. And he's very good at texture and rendering reality. But that's no less an abstraction than what, say, even Salvador Dali or Spare was doing.
Spare would agree with you on that, I think.
I mean,
it's all an abstraction, no matter what it is. But the point is that if you get your fundamentals down, you're able to warp reality in a way that is more believable and impactful to the general audience that you're presenting it to. And that, and I think that is where the magic that Spare saw in the art lied, is that you could affect a lot of people if you could warp reality in a certain way with your own. That's why I do art. I mean, this is like so cool.
Well, it's interesting to me as well when you think about art, or at least illustration, as like an effective magic medium, because when you get down to it, it's just the practice of making convincing lines on paper.
And or to illustrate what you see through your own lens. And
it's also like the more you draw and engage with that part of your brain, at least this is something that I found interesting in the brief periods where I did learn to draw and forgot and relearned. But it's like the more you use that part of your brain, the easier it gets to understand perspective and shading and visualize what you want to draw and then translate it to the paper.
I think it is a magical exercise, and I think this is why a lot of chaos magicians are not attracted to tomes of rules or writings or anything like this, because Spare actually is demonstrating that magical practice and in intuition itself and being acute in the practice is, I mean, you can link it down to just drawing pictures. It could be art. It could be through artwork or musical expression or even dance.
It doesn't even have
to be written down in a book in a rule set. And I think this is extremely powerful to understand that when people are making artwork or music, they are creating chaos magic. I mean, that's literally what it is in the barest sense. I mean,
that's what Grant said here.
Where are we right now?
Somebody besides Dingus should probably read this because Dingus needs to read the next part.
Somebody wants... No, I'm just kidding. Okay. It was this sensational coverage which attracted Aleister Crowley to him quickly, become a champion of his art, claiming it to be channeled directly from the divine. Bear subsequently submitted several drawings for the publication in Crowley's Thelemite journal, The Equinox, receiving payment in the form of an expensive ritual robe.
Woo!
Is that good though? I don't know.
Sexy.
You want to come over and show me how you look in that robe?
Buy now and get a free t-shirt.
It seems silly.
Buy now and get a free expensive ritual robe.
He was the seventh member of Crowley's Mystic AA instruction and testing, taking on the magical motto Frater Yehovenum. Spare was quick to hit off with Crowley's ass punishment buddy, Victor Newberg, who would later go on to aid Crowley in his work described in Vision and the Voice,
which was performed in the Algerian desert after a little bit of sodomy. Unlike his new friend Neuberg, Austin Osman, Spare would not hang out in the AA, becoming an outspoken critic of ceremonial magic and hierarchical lodge systems that Crowley spent his whole life attempting to dominate.
Respect.
That's why this guy is awesome. Because I like to read about that stuff, but if you're going to tell me I have to be in it for like 10 years to rank up to the next, it's like, fuck you. Like,
I never liked the idea of belonging to any kind of organized religious group or magical order. It just seems kind of restricted.
If everybody has the same interest, then it makes sense. Everybody's goal is the same. But that's impossible. It's impossible.
Others praise ceremonial magic and are supposed to suffer much ecstasy. Our asylums are crowded. The stage is overrun. Is it by symbolizing we become the symbolized? Were I to crown myself king, should I be king? Rather, should I be an object of disgust or pity? These magicians, whose insincerity is their safety, are but the unemployed dandies of the brothels. Magic is but one's natural ability to attract without asking. Ceremony, what is unaffected, its doctrine, the negation of theirs. I know them well and their creed of learning that teaches the fear of their own light. Vampires, they are as the very lice in attraction. Their practices prove their incapacity. They have no magic to intensify the normal, the joy of a child or a healthy person, none to evoke their pleasure or wisdom from themselves. Their methods depending on a morass of the imagination and a chaos of conditions. Their knowledge obtained with less decency than the hyena his food. I say they are less free and do not obtain the satisfaction of the meanest amongst animals. Self-condemned in their disgusting fatness, their emptiness of power, without even the magic of personal charm or beauty. They are offensive in their bad taste and mongering for advertisement. The freedom of energy is not obtained by its bondage, great power not by disintegration. It is not because our energy is already overbound and divided that we are not capable, let alone magical.
I think the part where he says vampires, they are the very lice in attraction. He's talking about these magicians, how they're vampires. And then just think about how a lice is in the idea of attraction, trying to get more blood or...
Well, it's a parasite,
yeah,
which is literally what a vampire is.
So they're in the act of attraction. They're just not fixated.
They can't give.
They're not
they
on the right.
They can only take.
Yeah, yeah. He doesn't like magicians because they're fucking parasites. They don't know how to give to the world.
Well, this is a sentiment I've heard in Satanism with Anton LaVey, where he would say something similar like, you probably know nothing that could add anything to a healthy person or like a child, where somebody who is like on that wave, according to his Satanist, would be able to make kids laugh, like at a birthday party, or gives a healthy person something to think about that would elevate their situation, where he's arguing here that, like, Aleister Crowley couldn't. Like, Aleister Crowley would be more inclined to just try and vampire that person.
For all the coke-fueled fucking he did, he was kind of a stick in the mud compared to Spare.
Hmm.
Or Blavatsky or anyone else, right? I mean, not just Crowley, but yeah.
Grim, dark. Spare became popular amongst avant-garde homosexual circles in Edwardian London. Avant-garde. Okay. With several known gay men becoming patrons of his work. In particular, he became good friends with the same-sex couple, I'm not even going to try and fucking French that shit up. Marc-André Mark Andre Raffalovich, and, oh, thank God, John Gray. Was scared, later characterizing the latter as the most wonderful man I've ever met. What? That's such a weird name. It starts French and then turns like, I don't know, not French. No, it's a fucked up name. And
if you can't pronounce it or spell it, they can't find you and lynch you because you're the wrong sexuality. Maybe that was
John McAfee.
While we're on this subject, let me just put this out there. Fuck any language that has R's in the back of your throat and takes 3 seconds to translate from, or takes 3 sentences to translate.
French
from one
people don't
to
want you.
And then John Gray went the opposite route. He's like, John Gray. I'm John
That's
Gray.
That's like the plainest name you can possibly
That's
have.
That's even worse than John Smith.
I think it's kind of cool because it's certainly not as popular as John Smith.
No. Smith is, dude, my brother-in-law's name is Smith and he's from Australia. Do you understand how common that name is?
Australia. Yeah, Australia. They were all Brits. I don't know. He sounds like, when I hear his name, I imagine he's the man who invented the fax machine.
I thought that was Dilbert.
Well, fuck. I guess you know more than me. Just a comic man?
So, no.
Maybe unfairly, because Spare hung out with gay people, there was much speculation about his sexuality at this time. His friend Frank would later claim that he was strongly homosexual and had suppressed these leanings.
Strongly homosexual.
That's the words he used. In contrast to this, in later life, Spare would refer to a wide variety of heterosexual encounters that took place at his time, including with an intersex person, a dwarf with a protuberant forehead, and a Welsh maid.
I thought most dwarves had protuberant foreheads. Is that fucked up? Should that make
it to the final because their skulls don't grow.
He would unsuccessfully...
they seem to have strong brows, that's all I'm saying. Okay, fine.
He would unsuccessfully also attempt to woo Sybil Waller, a daughter of Pickford Waller, as well as a young girl named Constance Connie Smith. It sounded like AOS just liked to fuck, though.
Down to fuck.
I'm a sick fuck. I like a quick fuck.
Oh, I love that song.
I've never even heard the whole thing. He would become married after meeting a Miss Shaw at the bar who was desperate to marry off her daughter. He would subsequently fall in love and did various portraits of her at this time. At the wedding, Spare choked on his wedding cake, something his bride thought hilarious. They moved into a house next to his old college friend Sylvia Pankhurst, who, unlike his wife, was not unintellectual and materialistic, which caused strain on the relationship. It was his association with the boys, however, that his wife detested the most, requesting that he ceased seeking their company altogether. Okay, I feel like
I could get that. You know, she can compete with all the other bullshit, but I guess she
didn't want all the younger guys hanging out all the time.
I mean, strap-ons weren't really popular at this time. She couldn't offer him what a man could.
Yeah, she can't do what a dude can do. You know, she's like, I can go and do that. All your other bullshit, I can. I don't know. Maybe that's how she felt. I don't know.
Spare's interest in the grotesque and occult flourished during this time. In 1913, he self-published The Book of Pleasure, which was conceived initially as a pictorial allegory, a book which quickly evolved to a much deeper work, drawing inspiration from Taoism and Buddhism, but primarily from his experiences as an artist.
A little bit of this, a little bit of that. Mostly made up, though.
The work includes Spare's immensely popular sigilization method, which is cornerstone to the modern chaos magic method. It involves the writing of one's desire in the present tense, removing vowels and arranging the remaining characters into a sigil that looks pleasing and enticing to the psyche, burying it in the subconscious, usually through some form of sexual exhaustion mixed with focus to produce the latent wish, desire, in manifest form.
I had a question about this, actually.
Sure. Let's dig into this. This is why we're here, I bet.
Write your desire in the present tense, but I've also heard that you can't use negative verbs.
That was something that I found out too, is that you have to, it's kind of like a genie, or you're asking the dragon from Namek to give you the Dragon Ball wish. You have to be very precise.
Yeah, and I have a hard time, like if I say I want to stop doing something, it's really hard for me to find I want to be the opposite of that.
Like if you say I want
the language to me trips me up, and I don't. Sigils for me are very specific, but yeah, like I make sigils in this manner, but at the same time, I have a hard time doing either, like, if you need to have a positive statement, like, I will not die, or I will not crash, or I will not be stupid, you know, like, how do you say do not when it's something that is kind of specific?
Yeah, to say do not, like, I want to stop anything. Like, if you use the word stop, like, I want to stop, then you're gonna stop.
But you use it in present tense, like, I stop this.
I've heard that you can write it as though you've already succeeded.
All right, here we go.
It has to be present, though, like, not as if you've already done it.
All right, listen, it should be in present tense in a positive. That is sort of positive. Part of the work is making sure you even know what your intention is. Much like when you verbalize your question while you're doing the tarot, just actually verbalizing the question and gathering your will into that question helps your mind wrap itself around it. So if you don't want something specific to happen, like this, you have this problem with this person and they're fucking with your shit, you don't want to be like, person, don't fuck shit up. You want to be like, my thing I'm trying to protect is protected. The thing precious is healthy and safe and defended. You know, that is a positive example.
So saying actively, I am healthy would be something that you could say to, like, I am not going to eat this fucking giant pile of food at 11 o'clock in the morning.
I am satiated until the morning.
Yeah, you have to think a different way. Like, I am not going to eat. Don't think about that. Just be like, I am full, or just don't think about that.
I am satiated.
Okay. I actually had like a successful spell recently, and it wasn't a sigil, but it was something I did pretty briefly where I, like, crossed my arms and made some runes between, like, my hands and my arms crossed over my chest, and I just prepared a statement. And I kind of entered into this, this kind of vacuous trance state. But really what you have to do, like, you just got to lawyer it a little bit. But as long as you know what you want, it'll work.
That's my issue, is sometimes I don't know what I want. And I don't know how to put that into words, which I really appreciate a lot of Spare's work. He subs symbols, and I mean, I'm really good at sigils. But the point across of making and being it with power is the words, and you have to choose them wisely or you might fuck yourself over.
Which gets me to what I said, what I did the spell for. So basically I ended up leaving a golf ball sized dent in someone's car, which I now suspect they may have actually hit me because it was just in a weird place. But anyways, so I didn't really have the money to pay for that, and he agreed to just do a cash deal. So my specific intent was that I would financially benefit from his obstruction. For whatever reason, he wouldn't be able to get an estimate, or, you know, just something would fall through. Well, his nephew got shot, and he just felt like his life was too hectic from that for him to deal with a dent in his car.
Oh, no.
I felt kind of good about it.
So, Dingus, did you have a specific declared statement in mind, or was it more like an idea, feeling? Like, did you ever verbalize it?
Yeah, it was a statement. I don't remember specifically what I said, but it was something along the lines of, I will financially benefit from this man's obstruction.
Okay, that was a fairly positive statement. I mean, if your statement includes negatives or antis or whatever, I don't think that necessarily sinks the boat. It's just not
it
as
broadens,
guaranteed.
Broadens the potential results a little bit.
Yeah, it might be more likely to backfire. It's not as well designed of a rocket. So you might want to go back to the drawing board if you find yourself with negative statements, but it's not guaranteed to fuck you up. It's like if you had taken that statement, right, and then you had written it out and you removed all the vowels and you took the remaining consonants and you turned it into something that you liked to look at, something that looked magic. That's pretty important.
Or just aesthetically pleasing.
Same thing, yeah.
Not a lot of detail. You want simplistic, as simplistic as possible.
If you're me, because you can't visualize things. Now, that's the popular way. That's the way we've heard about in the last podcast on the left. You jizz on it, right? Now, this is not necessary for the sigil to be charged, although partially because of Austin Osmond Spare, this is a popular way to charge the sigil, because what else are you supposed to infer from reading this shit? I have achieved results using these methods, but not through masturbating or ejaculating in exclusivity. What do I mean by that? I have done the sigil the exact same way he's described here by removing the consonants, etc., making something that looks magic, and then placing the sigil in front of me and just staring at it until my eyes burn out. That works just fine.
I have another technique that I hang it in a common space that I wake up and sleep in, like my room or my bathroom, and I put it in my kitchen. So every time I come home or I eat or I come in and out of the common space, I see it. And I don't even know what my sigil means anymore, but I know it's affecting me. And that's the effect that he wanted. You're supposed to plant it in your subconscious. The whole point of obstructing the language in that respect and making it a drawing or a sigil is to implant it in your subconscious, whereas your frontal lobe or the part of your brain that can parse language and social context, it subverts that part of your brain and it actually goes below.
Yes.
Okay. When you make a sigil like this, you often want to forget how you made it. The reason that Spare was so obsessed with obstructing the logical context of your sigil was because he understood that the subconscious is actually more powerful at manifesting physical reality than your logical brain.
Something I've done, and I do many times, but a quick example of I guess a very complex method. I make a sigil because I want to grow a plant, and I find like aloe vera here in the city, and I'll just take like a little piece of it that looks like it's dying.
Oh yeah.
And then I bring it home and I put it in a small enough pot so that it gets the right ratio. You know, you have to have some knowledge, I guess. It's not going to just happen because of magic. I wish I documented this and took photos. Life, it's a four-letter word. You don't need to create a whole new alphabet to make this happen. I will sit and look at a bush or trees in my neighborhood, and sometimes I'll see symbols in the leaves and the blowing of the wind. And
I see runes in nature all the time. Sorry.
And I'll write them down. And then I'll create a complex symbol from that. And it just means I guess all that means life. But I'll find the L, I'll find the I, the F, and the E. I don't take out the vowels all the time when it's something so simple like this.
Here's something I find.
House magic, man.
If you take the vowels out, they actually show up in the sigil regardless.
I'm making my own four-letter alphabet. I'm not making the whole thing, so I don't need to worry. I want all of its parts represented. You know, this is my method.
So you're making your own, it's like you're making sigils for the letters.
And then I'll get a piece of, you know, either some papyrus, some linen, something healthy for the plant. I put some consideration to it. I get some ash from my incense container that I have left over, and I'll write it on a piece of paper or cloth, and I'll bury it underneath the plant that I pot if it's big enough, you know, however size I need to do it. And I just meditate on it, you know, every day and put it in the sun. And you can do that. You don't have to destroy it all the time. It'll disintegrate.
The plant eats it.
You can see it grow. It's kind of a cool thing.
If you use unbleached paper, it'll provide nutrients.
Yeah. I don't use bleached paper. For sure.
Yeah. And then also, if you sit with the plant and think about it and meditate next to the plant, that actually helps it. And then you know what even helps it more is even talking to it. Talking to plants is actually scientifically proven to make them grow larger.
Man, this was like a Mythbusters episode. They tested to see whether or not plants grow quicker when you play the music. And apparently they do.
They do. Yeah, it's vibrational. It's a vibrational. Also, when you talk to them, if you get real close and you baby talk them,
so you're growing,
you're puffing CO2 on them, and they're inhaling it.
Grow the weed, grow the mushrooms in that dirt that you're charging up with your magic. Like,
but you have to love it. That's the whole point, is that mass manufactured shit can't be loved on that scale. And when we do it ourselves, we can actually imbue that love in it in the individual plants and stuff.
There's some anger gory right now that's so mad at you, Mari. Like, are you fucking kidding me?
I mean, how do you bless 1,000 plants when you can't talk to all of them individually?
Get some amps and play some fucking death metal.
Oh, dude. Oh, that's such a good idea.
Let's grow a crop of weed and just like have metal concerts all the time.
Like Viking longship rowers wasting away in the hours of the ship.
Malachor, we're going to do a secret experiment together.
Sure.
Okay. Why'd you say it on the show?
Does it involve ice cream?
Yes.
We can save the details for the Patreon.
I want to talk about the death posture because this shit is amazing.
Let's wrap up the free show with how to do the death posture, because we've talked about a sigil method and the death posture. And if we're going to talk a little bit more about his theory, you can tune into the extended episode at www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where $5 gets you access to our Discord server, a sticker that's probably worth at least $5, and access to all our extended episodes. So without further ado, how do death posture?
Can I read this one?
Yeah.
So you lie on your back lazily and your body expresses the condition of yawning. An open mouth smile or even a frown would be the idea of the posture. You forget time with those things which were essential, reflecting their meaninglessness. The moment is beyond time and its first you has happened. Stand on your tiptoes with your arms rigid, bound behind your back by your hands, clasped and straining the upnose, your neck stretched, breathing deeply and spasmodically till you're giddy and the sensation comes in gusts, giving exhaustion and capacity for the former. So basically, stand on your tiptoes, lock your arms behind your back, and open your mouth either in a frown or a smile. Do it in front of a mirror, gazing at your reflection until it is blurred and you do not know who is looking in the mirror anymore.
Oh, that's super interesting.
Look into your eyes, your own eyes, as it happens involuntarily because you're attracted to that anyway, and visualize what you're seeing. Blur it out. Just kind of go into your own space. And the light, always an X in a curious evolutions that a scene should be held on to. Never letting go until the effort is forgotten. And this gives a feeling of immensity, which sees a small form whose limit you cannot reach. This should be practiced before experiencing the foregoing. The emotion that is felt is knowledge, which why. So to me, this seems like a gazing in and out of yourself. So you need to be pensive and try to fill your vision with your own self.
It sounds like there's a pinhole of light going on that you fixate on as well.
And try to figure out what you look like when you're dead.
Well, it's through the eyes, but you're also, I mean, you're moving your face and you're straining your body, right? And you're keeping your neck upright, but you should be focused on your eyes.
Like rigor mortis or some shit.
So the death posture is its inevitability accelerated. Though we escape our unyielding delay by attachment, the ego is swept up as a leaf in a fierce gale of wind. In the fleetness of the indeterminable, which would be gazing into your own soul, that which is always about to happen becomes truth. Things that are self-evident are no longer obscure, you know, as by the own person, however they please, know as the negation of all faith by living through the experience, the end of the duality of the consciousness. Oh shit, did I not read that right? Things that are self-evident. So if you actually get to the state, you'll know this as the negation of all faith by going through it. It's basically the end of the day of your consciousness. So of belief, a positive death state, pretty much anything else would be sleep or a negative state where you're not conscious. This is the dead body of which all we believe, and we shall awake a dead corpse. The ego, in subjection to law, seeks inertion in sleep and death, and know that the death posture and its reality and annihilation of law, the annihilation of law, the ascension from duality, in that day of tearless lamentation, the universe shall be reduced to ashes, but he escapes the judgment. So what they're trying to say is that when you burned your ego in this the death pose is supposed to, basically, I would say that
Saturn,
it freezes,
black calcination.
It freezes and essentially it kills it, quote unquote. But I would argue that it holds it in a suspension so that it serve the annihilation of the body. So, Luke, you're familiar with ketamine.
Yeah.
So what is an ego death is that you cannot move and you cannot operate in the normal world. So when your ego is, but it has to continually observe the things that your body goes through or that your mind goes through, and it is powerless to intercede. And that is the whole point of this, is the death posture is a submission to the chaotic state of the universe.
It's supposed to just unfetter your consciousness from duality and its ego, like on demand if you do it right. And if you focus on the sigil while this is going on, it's supposed to blast it into the astral and plant it very deeply in the subconscious and the astral dirt, you could say.
Exactly.
So it's kind of like strong. Actually dying.
Because you're zooming out. You're like seeding it into the higher parts of spiritual reality because you're actually zooming out of your ego.
It's kind of like actually dying, you know, which is when the point where your body and your consciousness succumbs to entropy and you become part of the chaos again. I mean, ultimately, your ego is just the things that makes decision, the part of you that makes decisions based off of your conception of yourself. So you can really let it go for a while.
Yes, and that's the idea.
And that's your logical frontal lobe, right? So he's basically saying submit.
Return to monkey.
Submit to your lower basal instincts, which is your subconscious, your cerebellum, and your lower brain.
Yeah, and basically to eat carrots and shoot lasers.